Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. All right, Drew, hit it. Let's get this show on the road. Man, oh man. I saw a tweet yesterday, Molly Wood, that said, you know, the one thing this guy has learned from listening to this podcast, well, he's learned a lot, but the other thing he learned was, you and I are never ready for the music to start. And I just thought that was very
That's really true. That's really true. And today we had three extra minutes and we're still just goofing off.
I know. Yeah. We're like just kind of messing around. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the big show, Make Me Smart, me and Molly Wood. Tech, the economy, and culture, trying the best to keep up with what is going on. And oh my goodness, is there a lot going on. Today, we're going to talk about people going back to work, but more importantly, trying to do it while managing their kids who are not necessarily in school, who are not necessarily able to go to childcare. And we're going to talk about the whole dynamic because it is incredibly complicated and oh so real for so many parents.
We are. And we're going to talk about it in the context of because just, you know, word to the producers, I'm going to bring in a bunch of education here, too, because we're also having a conversation right this second. Everybody I know who has kids about schools, whether they're going to reopen, how they're going to reopen, what that's going to mean, whether people can continue to work. Because fundamentally, if you have parents in this country and they're at home with children, they're not getting as much work done as they were before. And they cannot get as much work done as they were before. And we're looking in many cases at parents who will be in that position through the end of the year. And we as a country have to get real serious about the fact that there can be no reopening if the kids can't go somewhere safe. So that's the plan for today.
So we're going to do that. We're going to have that conversation with Valerie Strauss. She's a reporter at the Washington Post. She's been covering education for a long, long time. Also talking and working in her recent reporting about childcare. So we hit the doubleheader today. We're going to get both of those with her. Valerie, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Valerie.
Are you, as am I, and I believe Ms. Wood is as well, as gobsmacked as the rest of us that everybody's talking about going back to work and reopening businesses, but there's scant conversation about childcare and schools?
I'm always gobsmacked about the way we talk about schools and childcare, but yes, particularly childcare. We hear a lot about schools, although nobody has any answers. Nobody knows exactly what to do. We hear very little about childcare, and in fact, the childcare system, what we call a system, is more fragile than the public education system, and is actually, experts say, in danger of collapse right now, which would be an enormous hit on the economy.
Yeah, you wrote about this in the Post, and I wonder, first of all, what do we even mean when we say America's childcare system?
That's a good question. Yeah.
Like, what is that system? Is it a federally funded system? Because I've certainly never, you know, I mean, I know we have some things like Head Start, but yeah, like, give us the overarching view of what that even means in this country.
Right. It's not really a system, as we know systems. It is a patchwork of like 675,000 different programs. Some, most of them are not licensed. Some of them are programs with multiple kids. Some of them are single providers in homes. It's a huge business. It's about $57 billion to $60 billion just for direct costs. And then when you spill over on goods and services, it can be up to $100 billion a year. And there is almost no talk about how to take care of children, particularly young children in this country, before the pandemic and even now. There has been some legislation, but it's unclear when it will pass. And even the $50 billion, for example, that Democrats put forth in the Senate would only stabilize right now what's happening. It wouldn't even begin to fix the problems.
Hmm. Okay. So.
that's a lot.
Yeah, it is. Look, this is a really subjective question, and it bounces off your answer to the first one, which is you're always gobsmacked by the way we talk about it or don't talk about it. Is there a way that we can reopen this economy fully without solving the school and child care crisis?
No. I mean, that's not even subjective. That's objective. People who have, you know, millions of people have kids, and they have to have a safe place for their kids. Now, they're used to having them in schools, and they're used to having them in child care programs, although it's very difficult for many parents to find affordable child care, even in the best of times. So there is absolutely no way to fully reopen the economy without fixing this problem. And there are no answers. There are no fixes right now that can do it.
What were, you know, it's been interesting as this conversation has evolved, because it's clear that a lot of white working parents are now just starting to discover what poorer people in this economy, or single moms in this economy, or people of color in this economy who are also economically disadvantaged, have experienced forever, which is childcare is expensive, out of reach, not always safe. Like, what are the problems, you know, if we go all the way back to the existing brokenness of the childcare system, what are the problems we have to start with?
Okay, getting back to your question about it being a system or not a system, like I said, it's this individual patchwork. And the only real federal response there has been is this subsidy program. The federal government provides subsidies that are targeted to help a certain number of eligible families to afford childcare. So unfortunately, there's a number of problems here. One is quality. A lot of these programs aren't quality, and that's something that experts have been trying to address for a very long time. As I said, most of the programs aren't even licensed. Another problem is that the people who work in childcare are among the least paid workers in America. They make maybe $10 an hour for doing what, you know, people consider the most important thing, which is taking care of kids. But somehow we don't think that that's worth paying a lot for. And you also have the problem of cost. It is really expensive. It's even expensive for middle-class families. So what low-income families do, it's really, really hard. There was a survey done in California, which is not a particularly hospitable place for childcare, believe it or not. A single parent with a median income would spend 60% of their salary on childcare. Mm-hmm. 60%. That's how much it can be. Average, you know, maybe $1,200 a month, $1,300 a month. Most families don't have that. So what families do is cobble things together, and families with resources, you know, can do it better and easier, but it's still not easy unless you're very, very wealthy. It's still not easy for middle-class families.
Yeah.
I remember paying 60% of my income for childcare and getting to public school kindergarten and being like, this is amazing. How much money would you like at the auction? Right.
Exactly. Right. Well, that's part of what's happening now, is that some people are looking at the opening of school as a child care effort. And so they're pushing to reopen schools in some places, I suspect, for that reason. I mean, what would have compelled the governor of Florida this week to insist that all the school districts have 5-day-a-week learning in school for parents who want it, even while Florida is the biggest outbreak right now, and you know, looks like there's no stopping it for a while. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a childcare issue and an economy issue.
Right.
The front page of the Miami Herald today was governor orders schools open, and then right down below the fold was governor orders bars and restaurants closed. And you're like, right? Mm-hmm. How does that work?
Yes. There you go. That, right in a nutshell.
Yeah. Right. I was doing an interview the other day, and I asked the person, and we were talking about Black Lives Matter and the protests and all of that. And I said, do you think this time feels different in that it might actually change some things? And she said, without even hesitating, oh, yeah, and I'll tell you why. It's because white people are out on the streets too. And so the corollary question, I think, with childcare and schools is, do you think this time might change the conversation about childcare and education? And if you do, is it because white people are now going, holy cow, this is a really big problem for me?
Yes and yes. I think that's exactly what happens. That's how change happens, you know. People get affected and so, oh my gosh, it can happen to me. And that is what's happening with the Black Lives Matter protests, which is kind of a wonderful thing to see, that so many people have been participating and in the fight for racial justice. But yes, in terms of childcare, I think there has to be some changes. At least there will be changes in the amount of money the federal government gives to these programs. That would be a start. It's not all, but it's a start. That doesn't fix the problem permanently. It doesn't create an actual system in which states would create licensed childcare programs in which families could go. But it will help what there is now.
Can you give us a sense of what the conversation is about financial assistance from the federal government? Because it feels like it's not a big part of the conversation. And this is where I point out that women disproportionately are facing major setbacks as a result of this. I think I saw somewhere, I was trying to look it up actually while you were talking, that something like 47% of working mothers said they would have to drop out of the workforce if school doesn't resume or childcare isn't somehow subsidized. And yet, I am not seeing that as part of our stimulus conversation.
Right.
Which what?
That's nutty, because like, if you're a policymaker, how do you look at that as a policymaker and say, oh, no, this is fine. We're going to lose half the women in this workforce.
And even just say, this is fine for the economy. You cannot have a recovery.
Right.
Even if you don't care about women and equality, you can't have a recovery. Now the rage is coming
absolutely
back.
Absolutely. I mean, even before the pandemic, you know, women were hit harder with childcare issues. Mothers were 40% more likely than fathers to report that they had to make adjustments to their careers so they could take care of kids. I'm not saying that they shouldn't take care of their kids, but women get impacted much more and now really are, particularly during the pandemic. There were studies done and more than 60% of parents found that their childcare programs had closed. Now, some of them have opened, but many of them have to operate on social distancing rules, which means they can't bring back as many students. Many of them can't open because they operate normally on very thin margins like restaurants do, and they're out, they're gone. And we don't know what percentage now of the millions of slots that families depend on will be open this fall. That will be open in the winter. It's like we're seeing 40% of restaurants are probably never going to reopen. Well, that's one thing. But when you're talking about childcare slots, that's another thing.
Right. Okay. So look, let's talk next steps and how this might, and let's admit we're talking very long term. Let's think about how this might get fixed. Number one, you've already said, is more federal dollars. What else has to happen?
There has to be a concentration on quality, okay? There has to be better licensing efforts. They have to be enforced. The federal government could decide, federal funding goes through to families. So the idea would be to actually create a system in which the states have, with the help of federal funding, create high quality childcare programs for everybody who needs them.
Right.
And then you make them very, very affordable, or you make them free. And so you get cost, you get quality, and you get capacity. Those are the three things you really need to do.
If you were a betting woman, Valerie.
How do you know I'm not?
And perhaps you are.
Yes. Step A, are you a betting woman? And B, what do you think are the odds of that happening? Let me make it less subjective. I know you're a reporter. where are we with that conversation right now? I know the Senate Democrats have introduced a child care and education relief bill. Is it going anywhere?
I think it will go somewhere at some point. The problem is there will be some more money, even from Republicans, on this issue. The question is, part of the question is when. For example, it's not just childcare programs that say they need the money right now and it's not coming right now, but school systems are. There's a number of school systems that say they cannot open safely without much more federal money now. And the House has passed that money. The Senate, not so much. And they seem to be in no rush to do it. So you have, for example, San Diego Unified School District has announced it's going to reopen schools for all students for the first half of the year because they're expecting the Congress to come up with the money for them to do it for the second half of the year. But if they don't, then everybody's going to have to go home.
Yeah. Okay. So we remain on the high wire. Valerie Strauss is a Washington Post reporter covering education and childcare. Valerie, thanks so much. We really appreciate the context.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you. Bye.
Take good care.
Huge challenge, but so important. It's like instrumental.
It really is like everything, actually.
Yep.
Yeah. We report, you decide. I don't know. We're headed for a break. Where we go. And I mean, we should point out, when we have this conversation too, we're not only talking to parents, we're talking to all of the people without kids who have to pick up the disproportionately high amount of load because, I can't work that much. And people with young kids at home can't, or me with my 13-year-old can, in theory, do more work by ignoring him than someone with a 2-year-old can, but then he doesn't win. And I mean, nobody can kind of operate at status quo.
Right. My kids are getting a lot more screen time now than they used to. Let me just tell you that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? I mean, we didn't even touch on this with Valerie, but it's the social emotional development. Pediatricians are starting to talk about how school should probably reopen, dangers be damned, because it is so bad. You know, the educational outcomes are bad. The emotional development is bad. The depression, socialization for children. This is such a huge issue to set back a generation of kids this much with no plan. I mean, that is the future of our country. That is pretty bad. It's pretty bad.
Send us your thoughts. Voice memo, email, take your pick. MakeMeSmartMarketplace.org. We're coming back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Maybe. I might bolt.
I don't know. Maybe we're not. We might just leave.
I'm out. Oh, we're biscuits.
Back.
We're back.
I'm out. We're back. Okay, we're back with a little bit of news. I've got mine. You got yours. What do you want to talk about?
I believe they're somewhat related, but you begin, please.
I believe they are. Uh-huh. So I will begin with an interview that a guy by the name of Rafael Bostic gave to the Financial Times. He is the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. He's been on Marketplace a couple of times. Black economist. did time in the Obama administration, has been with the Fed in various stints. Anyway, he gave an interview to the Financial Times, and I will say, I will preface this by saying I always really enjoy my conversations with him, but he said in this interview that the U.S. recovery might be, and this is the quote, leveling off. And all I can think of was, how do you think it's only leveling off? The virus is spiking all over this country, right?
Right.
Consumers are not going to go to places where they are going to get sick and conceivably infect others. I think leveling off is charitable. I think right. It's really it's so obvious to me that we're going to have a second leg down in this, what is going to be like a WWWWW shaped recovery, right? Because that's the way it's going to go. It's going to bounce up and down and up and down. I just love him, though I do. I think he's being a little bit not as plain spoken as he needs to.
I like that you were like, the long preface of all due respect, sir. You wish. Yeah. You wish.
Yeah. Yep.
We were leveling up.
So that's my news item. The moral of the story here is buckle up, because it's going to be really bouncy for a long time.
Yeah. And it's going to be it's a long road. I mean, look, even in places, and, you know, just to take the focus off of America and our response for just a second, even in places that have legitimately leveled off in terms of infections, like Australia, they're having to reclose. Like, they're having to put more shelter-in-place orders in place because infections keep spiking. Like, there is not, you know, there's not a situation where the virus itself is gone globally. And we in the United States may have even lost control in some places of our like, literally our ability to contain it. Long road. Even if I wanted to spend money, there's nowhere for me to go. You know, I drove up to Point Reyes this weekend and with my son to get a bunch of cheese, which was very exciting. And there was like a clothing store that was open, and all the clothes were so ugly, and I just still wanted to go in and buy them all. All of them. And I did, and I kept my money on the sidelines.
Did you? Really? Interesting. And clothing, of course, has been hit the worst of pretty much any sector of retail, down like 90% in April or something. So, yeah.
Totally. And it's just, and look, I mean, restaurants, I don't want to sound brutal, but they're done. Like, restaurants are done.
Good thing you don't want to sound brutal. Oh, my goodness.
Sorry. I apologize for sounding brutal, but like, get real, you know?
Yeah.
Get real. How are they supposed to stay open at a third capacity?
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. Long road. With the growing awareness of the long road in mind, and we did predict this, we have been saying on this show, like, that at some point, you know, Congress was going to catch the snap and realize that that more stimulus was required, and they probably did. Now there is a little bit more conversation. In fact, as of yesterday, Monday the 6th, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that a second stimulus check, an actual financial assistance, direct assistance to people, could well be part of the next relief bill, but that it should be, they believe, much more targeted, and that it would be directed at people who make about $40,000 a year or less.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't seen that little bit. And the reason that resonates with me, sorry, is that Jay Powell, in a press conference a month ago, said 40% of, I'm pretty sure the stat is right, 40% of people, households making $40,000 or less, had experienced job loss that month.
Yeah, exactly.
And this was like April or May, right? So,
I think that's where the hurt is, even.
That's where the pain is. Yeah.
Yep. That's exactly where the pain is. In fact, that exact stat is in this Forbes article where I saw this quote from Mitch McConnell, close to 40% of Americans earning less than $40,000 annually. And look, I mean, I actually don't think this is a case of, I think there's some faux outrage about the deficit for sure. But I don't think that this is a case of Congress being particularly stingy. This is, in fact, the people who sincerely need this the most for food and housing. For, you know, actual shelter, there will be questions about, you know, it will certainly dramatically reduce eligibility. But let's not forget that our government sent out something like $1.2 billion, over $1 billion in stimulus checks to people who had died.
Well, yeah, I mean, I could quibble with that, right? Because the rule was, if you filed the tax return in the eligible year, you got the money.
Yeah.
Right.
That's exactly
what they did. They were just shoveling money out the door. Same thing with the PPP.
They were shoveling money out the door.
Yep. Right.
And now, and anyway, you know, now they're going to try to be a little more targeted. I don't think that means it needs to be slower. Like, great, be targeted faster.
Right.
And include again, and include childcare. Right. But it was, that was an interesting note, and suggested that at least that these conversations, we are not in fact starting at zero. They're happening.
Right.
Which is something, right, I guess. Yeah, that's something. All right. And that's it for the news fix. It is now your turn to talk.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
We had a conversation last week with Scott Galloway from NYU, which I really enjoyed, about higher education, about some of the just fallacies that those schools are telling each other and us and their students, and some of the changes that actually are going to have to come. Anyway, here is what Philip Vieira had to say about that.
Hi, Make Me Smart team. I'm a professor at a university in Southern California, and I enjoyed the recent discussion around higher education. I do agree that a college degree should be available to more people. But in speaking with my colleagues, there is a lot of skepticism around how technology would enable this. It feels like we've been trying to get online education right for many, many years now, and yet students still struggle in that sort of environment. This is particularly difficult for non-traditional students who really do benefit more from face-to-face interaction. This opens up the possibility for haves and have-nots. Thanks for all the good discussion.
Yeah, and thanks for the thoughts. I guess the question is it a question of how technology is going to be able to do that, or whether, right? Because if we had really good investment in education technology like we do in, oh, I don't know, iPhone technology, right? That'd be something. Mm-hmm. That'd be something.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say we don't know what it looks like. You know, we know that massively open online courses had pretty low success rates because people didn't stay engaged and they dropped out. But we also know that there wasn't a lot of accountability, and people weren't paying $50,000 a year to take those classes and get the degrees from them. So we, like right now, we have worse outcomes with online education. Yep. But I think it is true that we really don't know what could be accomplished with that level of investment. But I agree that the possibility of haves and have nots is, I mean, that already exists. But at least you could get a scholarship to go to a school and live on campus and learn. It's very hard. If we're going to move to an online model in the long term, then we're going to need scholarships that provide internet access and computers in the same way that it would have gotten a kid physically to a school. I think Scott's overriding message was haves and have nots. It's like the whole higher education conversation in a nutshell.
Yeah.
So there's that too.
100%.
Yeah. 2 weeks ago, we played a voice memo from a listener, Joe Wodenschek, who had found a silver lining in his pandemic experience by starting a business he had dreamed about for years but did not have time to focus on until now. And so we're doing that again today. More silver linings. Here's listener Katie Sullivan.
Hi, Kai and Molly. You were talking recently about silver linings for startups during COVID. I'm a Vermont sheep farmer with a new sideline buying New England wool, employing local mills to spin it into yarn, and wholesaling that yarn to local yarn shops. Tiny as it is, my little business touches the huge economic themes of our time: local agriculture, onshore manufacture, and new alternatives to in-person big box shopping. I'm counting on people staying home and knitting this summer instead of vacationing and gathering. Looking at Australian wool prices lately, I'm reasonably confident that supply and transport disruptions will trickle through the globalized world of textiles to give my hyper-local effort a boost. Thanks for the pod. My sheep and I listen to it together sometimes.
I'm sorry. So I freaking love that. I freaking
love
that
so much. I know I'm dying.
That might be my favorite listener letter ever. Ever.
Can you make her a regular? You know how you have that awesome farmer lady now? Can you also include sheep farmer?
That's right. What a good idea. What a good idea.
I mean, seriously.
Sorry, I'm just going to write this down. Right?
Katie Sullivan. Yes. Like, monthly. I love this. Also, I think we should do an episode on onshore manufacturing. I think that is a super interesting, like, we've talked about, what do you think, listeners? We have talked about sort of how to tackle the idea of globalization as a driver of so many of the politics that we've seen, so many of the economic disruptions of the last 50 years or so. And I feel like this question of onshore versus offshore is really significant. I think I saw a story today about, Joe Biden put out a plan based around bolstering U.S. supply chain capabilities, which is like a sign of the times if I ever heard one.
Yep, for sure.
Katie Sullivan and the sheep. That? So great.
Sheep farmer in Vermont.
Also,
that's awesome.
I see you, Katie. I'm totally sitting home knitting this summer, whether I want to or not. All right. We do not have a Make Me Smart question today, or an answer, rather. So please send them at makemesmart@marketplace.org. But a little birdie told me that Kai might have an answer.
Well, so there's something that's been bugging me lately. Actually, there are many things that have been bugging me lately. But when we realized we didn't really have a Make Me Smart answer that we wanted to use, I got to thinking. And I got to thinking about, and I'm sure you remember this, the couple of times that you and I have answered this question, mine is always a variation of, I always thought, but it turned out I was wrong about, if you kept your head down and you did your job and you did it right, things would work out and you would fundamentally be rewarded and everything would be good. And I think the pandemic corollary to that is, if you wear your mask and you stay away from people when you're out in public and you do everything right, everything's going to be okay because people understand that and we're going to kill this disease. And I was wrong about that. I mean, demonstrably, I was wrong about that. And that makes me crazy, right? I mean, wear a freaking mask. Wash your hands. That's it.
Care about other people.
That was my – care about other people. Be responsible.
Care about other people.
Take leadership even if none is being offered, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I got.
Hi. You have
what?
Perfectly, almost to the word, articulated everything that I'm feeling this week.
Okay.
Agree. Good. Endorse okay. what he Good. Said.
Boom.
And that's it for our show today. Don't forget to sign up for the Make Me Smart newsletter at marketplace.org/newsletters. Please send us your answers. That question one more time. What is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? So many things, friends. So many things. We will be back tomorrow with What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. So also email your questions to makemesmart@marketplace.org with the subject line questions. Oh, I heard a critter. And we'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah, that was on my end. Dog number one decided to be heard.
We got critters. We got kids.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed
by
Steve
Tony
Anderson.
Wagner.
Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. That's me. I also read the podcast ads. Thanks to our video producer, Ben Heathcote, our video intern, Ethan Peretz, and writer-producer, Erica Phillips. Today's program was engineered by Drew Josted and mixed by Garrett Lang. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
Nice.
The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
There we go. So that's Erica
Boom.
Down. We got Tony down. There's like 3-4 more to go.
We got more.
Y'all wanted to hear what they sound like, do we?
I love it. I like Tony's full disclosure, too. He's like, yes, I am the ad guy.
Yeah, right? Well, it's always fun
in case you're wondering.
Match the voice.
Yeah. It's also me. I have a very red face today. I'm going to warn all our video viewers because I went on a rage run
coming
right
off a workout?
Before the show.
There you go. Mm-hmm. A rage run?
A rage run. Sometimes when you're so mad and you don't know what to do with it, the only thing to do is run and then you feel amazing.
You're so right. You're so right.
I know. It really worked. It really worked, you guys.
Endorphin.
It's going to be a great show.
It's really funny. That's really funny.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.